Good morning. This joint meeting of the House Education and Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 8:04 a.m., Wednesday, March 14th, 2018. As Representative Parrish just reminded me, it's Pi Day, 3.14. Members present around the table are from both committees. We have Representative Kopp, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Parrish, Representative Jennifer Johnston, Representative Garen Tarr, Representative Tiffany Zolkuski, and Representative Ivy Sponholz, and myself, Representative Harriet Drummond, Chair of House Education. And I apologize, Representative Sponholz is Chair of House Health and Social Services. And we have quite a bit of overlap on the two committees. Several members serve on both committees, including Representative Sponholz and Representative Zolkuski. And Representative Johnston. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. And I apologize, where is Representative Kito? Is he going to be sitting with us? Okay, great. Representative Kito is also present, who is on the Health and Social Services Committee. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Sandy Edwardson from House Records and Madison Truitt from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. We are going to be hearing, beginning today, for a couple of hours. We will have a presentation from Angie Galanos on preschool. Representative Sponholz and I have been looking at the various services that are provided to our youngest citizens across both departments, education and health and social services, and looking to see what kinds of services are provided, to what extent, and whether there is redundancy. I doubt that is. I think the departments are doing an excellent job in serving our communities, but I am very interested in making sure that our youngest citizens are ready to learn when we begin to make that enormous investment in them when they arrive in kindergarten. And I want to look at what we're doing for them, what we're providing for them before, actually from birth and prenatal, before they get to school at the age of five. Representative Sponholz?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Drummond. I guess I just wanted to add, you know, Representative Drummond and I have been talking about this for some time. The impetus for this hearing was you know, questions about the relationship between programs in the Department of Health and Social Services and the Department of Education and Early Development, and whether there might be redundancies or how they might dovetail with one another. We know that children and families don't come to us with education or health needs. They come to us with their own family and individual needs, and we need to learn to meet them where they are. And so we decided to spend three committee hearings today, tomorrow, and Friday exploring how it is that the programs that are designed to serve children prenatal to five and maybe switching up a little bit to seven, because that's what the developmental approach recommends that we do, how they dovetail with one another, how they complement one another, where the challenges may be, where the opportunities are. I think it's particularly important that we look at this prenatal to five group, because we know that return on investment is so high during this time. Brains are growing so fast. They're pruning during this time. We want to make all the right choices, and so I'm pretty excited and want to thank Representative Drummond for partnering with me and for all of the committee's indulgence for the next 3 days as we explore this topic. I look forward to an interesting conversation. Thank you.
All right. Now we'll turn our attention to a presentation from Angie Galanos. Ms. Galanos, would you please come forward, put yourself on the record, I believe for the final time. Mm-hmm. I want everyone to know that we have benefited from Angie Galanos' service to the state of Alaska and the state of Department of Education and Early Development, and she is leaving Alaska to go to work for, I believe it's the state of Colorado, Department of Education, Early Development section, and I will miss you greatly. Please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
For the record, I'm not going to start by crying.
Me neither. I'll try not to.
For the record, this is Angie Galanos, and I serve as the Early Learning Administrator for the Department of Education and Early Development for the state of Alaska. And
good morning. My name is Santa Eford. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Learning, and I'm basically sitting here to hopefully try to glean and learn from Angie before she takes off and leaves us so that we can continue the amazing work that she's been doing within the realm of early childhood education. So part of what I want to do is to express a huge thank you to her for her work in this area and to say she will be greatly missed by the department, and I'm not sure how we're going to replace her. So thank you, Angie, for that, and we wish you the very best in your next adventure. But you will be greatly missed. So quickly, I would also like to say thank you to the joint committees here. We very much appreciate and are excited about the interest that you're showing in pre-K. As most of you know, the department embarked on a year-long initiative called the Alaska's Education Challenge. And early childhood and pre-K programs were identified as an area that will make the biggest difference in the achievement and in closing the achievement gap for our students. So as we work together to collaborate with other agencies, in particular Health and Social Services and the Early Childhood Coordinating Council with all of our providers, we're excited to look forward to the future and what that's going to mean for our children in the birth to 7-8 range as we focus on them in the coming years in the future. The department, of course, is our programs are focused on 3-5 with our statutory focus for the department. So we know we've got to reach across other departments to look at the whole span so we make sure we are looking at the whole child. So with that, I will turn this over to Angie, and again, thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Santa. Again, for the record, Angie Galanos, and I also want to say thank you. My portion for presenting to you this morning is to present to you a really fantastic collaboration that I believe has been happening in our state for many years, the Alaska Early Childhood Coordinating Council. It truly represents a comprehensive and collaborative partnership between the Department of Health and Social Services and the Department of Education, as well as the many private agencies that represent the hard work that our state is doing for children birth to age 8. And so today I have an opportunity to tell you a little bit about that and hope you can learn more about it and just engage you in that process. So I serve as staff for the Alaska Early Childhood Coordinating Council, which I'm also going to refer to as the AECCC. Some people call it the ACCC, but we'll just stick with AECCC. And I also serve along with Rebecca Morrissey from the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Public Health, and she serves with me as co-staff. And I believe Rebecca is on the phone.
Yes, I have Rebecca Morrissey. Are you on the phone with us, Rebecca?
Yes, I'm here, Angie.
Okay, great.
Thank you. And I'll note that as I am leaving, Rebecca can be reached after my departure if you have any follow-up questions. Again, our goal in presenting this information about the council is to provide the legislature with just a few discussion points that I thought would be important for you to understand. We wanted to start with an opportunity for you to see an overview, just a really high-level overview of how early childhood advisory councils operate in other states. We wanted to speak a little bit about the need to continue the work for the advisory council in Alaska and give you a sense of the structure and provide an opportunity to demonstrate to you how we've used the structure of the AECCC to really frame the next few days for you so you can really see the joint collaboration that happens within our state. So for your understanding, I'm going to provide, like I said, a really high-level overview of early childhood advisory councils in our country. Nearly all governors in our country have a designated advisory council to advise policymakers. Often the councils are charged with developing a high-quality, comprehensive system of early childhood development and care, but they can also help ensure statewide coordination and collaboration among the wide range of early childhood programs and services in the state. These programs can include child care, Head Start, IDEA preschool, infants and family programs, as well as kindergarten programs and services. Our state early childhood advisory councils also help provide a wide role in the state, depending on progress that states are making in early childhood. And they also provide sort of a clarity about the primary mission of what early childhood is within that state. And they really do help to serve to define a scope for early childhood.
Excuse me one moment. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Yes, ma'am. May I ask a question?
Yeah, but we have a lot to cover today, so please keep it brief.
Absolutely.
Thank you and good morning. I'm just looking at the map here, and does it give a correlation with regard to which states actually have the advisory councils and which ones don't, based on the colors, or kind of how is that delineated?
Through the chair, I don't have a representative map to define for you, but I can provide one of where they are. So the map, this particular graphic isn't really representative.
Oh, all right, very good. Thank you.
Sorry for the confusion.
See, that was brief. Kept it short.
Short answer, no.
Yeah.
Okay. I would have asked why is Alaska at 1/4 scale down by San Diego? But that's a problem all of we Alaskans have.
Through the chair, duly noted, my graphics will be improved the next time I come through for Alaska. So back on topic. In states that already have these strong commitments, they also have a strong advisory council that is really supported by state efforts. And again, they really can help channel systems and energy in building and developing a really clear roadmap of what the state wants for policy in early childhood development. Every state's policy council is different. There are federal initiatives that do require the formation of participation in state advisory councils in order for our state to receive funds. So in other words, it is a federal requirement that states have early childhood advisory councils in order to receive some of those federal funds, and I'll go through those now. So we have several federally funded early childhood programs, and the ones that I've represented are just a few examples. But the first one is Head Start. The Head Start Act, Section 64B, lots of parentheses, requires that the governor of each state designate or establish a council to serve as the state advisory council on early childhood education. So this is a requirement for our state to receive federal funds for Head Start. The Maternal Infant Early Childhood Home Visiting Program also requires participation in a state advisory council to receive their federal funding, and so they rely on the Head Start Act to require or to meet that participation requirement and to define that. And also, in order to receive federal funds from the child care development funds from federal funds, we also have to have our child care programs at the state level participating in an advisory council, statewide advisory council. So these are just a few of the federal programs that require participation in a state advisory council and kind of give us the framework for why we need to have a state advisory council for early childhood. This slide kind of just outlines a little bit of the history of the AECCC. The council was formed in 2010 when then Governor Sean Parnell issued an administrative order designating an interdepartmental Early Childhood Coordinating Council. This council was not set under boards and commissions. I don't have the history as to why, but we can find that out. And therefore, it doesn't have identified funded staff for the position. The council later moved forward with an MOA signed by the commissioners of DHSS and DEED, clarifying the roles and the responsibilities for each agency and determining that the council would be jointly facilitated by both departments. Previously, the council, when it was the IECCC, was just departmental staff, and then later it formed to bring in more programmatic staff from the communities. Over the last 2 years, the council's worked to maintain collaboration and partnerships, and in 2015, we received a grant from the National Governors Association to really look at our foundation and our framework, and at that time, We worked with both commissioners to redefine the role of the council and how it would work, and we included two additional commissioners, the commissioner from the Department of Labor and Workforce and the commissioner from the commissioner from Public Safety. The council also then organized to work on specific priorities and goals, and then connect those goals through subcommittee work. So we identified specific subcommittees that could carry out the priorities and goals for those that were set with that work, with that committed work that came from that grant from the NGA. So this graphic just shows the current structure of the AECCC. You can see that it's jointly chaired by the commissioner of from the Department of Education and the commissioners from Health and Social Services. Departmental staff are identified to provide support to the council. So for example, I'm a staff, and then Becky Morrissey is the designated staff from Department of Health and Social Services. And then we've further broken our work, or grouped our work into standing committees, and there are five standing committees: Healthy Start and Strong Families, Data and System Alignments, High Quality Early Care and Education, Innovation and Long-Term Investment, Public Education, and Community Partnerships. Recently, we made a decision, and you'll see this as we speak a little bit later, to combine innovation and long-term investment with the public engagement and community partnerships because we felt that their priorities were aligned. So the graphic that you're going to see as we move through these next few days is a graphic that was provided to us by Department of Health and Social Services, who came up with a way to show how this collaboration works through these subcommittees. So you'll see this repeated throughout the presentations as we move through the next few meetings. But it really shows the subcommittees, the collaboration, the work that they do together. And then you'll also see that data and system alignment really works together to flow throughout. So I've listed for you the AECC member chairs, the people, the agencies, and state programs and private programs that really make up the whole of the AECCC. So just I'll quickly go through them. So for the public side, we have a representative from the Office of the Governor, the commissioners for DHS, DOL, and Public Safety, the D Director for Student Learning, the Head Start Collaboration Director, which also for Department of Education has been me over the last 3 years, the Part C Early Intervention Program Manager, the Child Care Program Manager from the Department of Health and Social Services, the Early Childhood Comprehensive Systems Program Officer, a representative from UAA, and a representative from the Alaska Mental Health Board. So those are the public representatives for the AECCC. And then on the private side, we have the Association of Alaska School Administrators. So we have a superintendent representative, Association of School Boards, Association of Infant Learning, Child Care Resource and Referral, Alaska Head Start Association, Alaska Native Health, the Libraries Association, the Alaska Children's Mental Health, Alaska Children's Trust Mental Health Representative, Best Beginnings, a parent representative, and a business community representative. So really you can see when you look at the full membership, the comprehensive and collaborative effort that is happening just in the representation of the membership.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Representative Zilkowski.
Thank you. Just a clarifying question. Can you identify, is when you refer to Alaska Native Health, is that somebody from the tribal health community? Can you clarify?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Zilkowski. At this point in time, we have Matt Hirschfeld from the All-Alaska Pediatric Partnership, and he serves as that representative in that space as well.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the public section, I see there's a representative from UAA. Is there a reason why it's specified as UAA rather than being from the UA system?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, it can be UAA, UAF, UAS. At this point in time, I apologize, but it should also read UAF or UAS. And at this point in time, Veronica Plum from, I'm going to forget the part that she's from, but it's early childhood program, CDC or something. Veronica Plum from the University of Alaska Fairbanks is serving in that position.
Thank you.
So again, going back to the subcommittees, are chaired by volunteers from the membership that I just listed off for you. And I have a full list of the names of the committee chairs for you that I'll submit to you. But these are the subcommittees and the organizations or programs that represent them. So Healthy Start and Strong Families, they're chaired by the Alaska Native Health Representative and the Association for Infant Learning Programs. data systems alignment is represented by the Alaska Mental Health Board position. High quality early care and education is chaired by the representative from UAF and the child care program manager from DHSS. Innovation and long-term investment is chaired by a representative from the Alaska Head Start Association and a business community representative. And then public and community engagements partnerships is a representative from the Alaska Association of the School Boards, Alaska Children's Trust, and Best Beginnings. So it just gives you an opportunity to see where they fit in the overall picture of the AECCC. So I mentioned earlier that each of the subcommittees operate with an agreed-upon set of priorities, and the priorities are updated periodically based on the recommendation of the subcommittee chairs. So really what they do is they do the work for a year, they engage with their priorities, they engage other members that are not on the AECCC. So the role of the subcommittee is to really reach out across the state and identify other people who may be beneficial to the work for that particular priority. That can help them address that and help them really identify whether or not this is the priority that Alaska needs to be working on at this point in time and whether this is really one of the unique needs that this committee needs to bring to the full committee. And so they're tasked not only addressing these priorities but identifying stakeholders that could also help participate in this process. I've listed out the priorities, and I won't read them for you just in the interest of time, but I do have those written for you, but you can see that we did, again, with that grant that we received from the National Governors Association, we really did sit down and say, what are the priorities in our state for early childhood, for children prenatal through age 8? What do we need to work on, and how can we best do that in our subcommittee format, and what's the best way to really carry out this work? So each of those subcommittees is tasked with meeting regularly, more regularly than the full AECCC, and really evaluating those priorities and making a decision on whether those are the best fit. Do you want me to read those out loud, or?
No, I think we have them, and they're up on the screen.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ms. Lawless.
So as I mentioned when discussing the structure of these meetings that you have coming up, we felt it would be really helpful to frame this comprehensive collaborative work happening between the departments and with private agencies in a way that fit with our existing work within the council, so that you could really see what our priorities as the full council were, and you could see what we're doing collaboratively to work together in the state. The council's really, our primary objective is to support young children across the state with all of the needs that they have, and to ensure that if there are crossovers, that they're efficient, that they're serving the communities that they need to serve, and that they're really being reviewed to assure that we're creating consistent, cohesive systems. Over the course of this meeting, you're going to hear about programs within our state supporting young children birth to 8. You can frame these presentations, like I said, under the context of the AECCC. And I think I really do speak for all the representatives from the AECCC when I say that we really welcome your questions. We do acknowledge that we have work to do with this council. It is not a perfectly framed organization at this point in time, and we have to continually strive to make sure that we're doing what we need to do for the programs and the children within the state to stay focused on that as well. So I'd be happy to provide you with more information and answer your questions.
All right. Any questions from the committee on this first section? Representative Johnston. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you through this chair. Going back to the slide as far as each of the committee's priorities, I was interested in the innovation and long-term investment. There seems to be it says here, protect prenatal funding and Title V and a number of early childhood programs, infant and mental health, behavioral health, oppose Medicaid block grants and repeal Affordable Care Act, and increase braided funding opportunities, expand access. It's others, as I read the other ones, it's data, we're trying to take data, and we're trying to set benchmarks, and we're trying to see what's working and not working. And this one, it says innovation and long-term investment, but it seems to be more of a political statement than one that matches some of the other ones in the other categories.
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, the best I can do to answer that question is to say that as a full council, we're represented not just by state agencies, but also by public agencies that are working hard to assure that funding is in place for young children in the state. The council doesn't have the role of being able to advocate directly for funding because it's co-chaired by both commissioners and because of the state representatives that are on that. But a part of the council also works that are made up of public or private agencies to really form the Alaska Advocacy, Early Childhood Advocacy Group. And in this particular group, you can see we don't have state representatives on these two groups, and they felt the priorities for this, again, this was a full collection of identifying priorities. They felt that the need at the time when these priorities were established were to really define and defend the funding that was in place. So
these two committees are fully, they're other than public members.
Yes.
Because I was looking, I mean, all we see is a chair of representatives, so I.
Yes. And as I, through the chair, Representative Johnston, as I said, we really sat down as a full committee, and we had to represent the full work of what's happening in the state. And at the time when these priorities were set, and these priorities are about 3 years old now, what the council really felt was at the time they really needed to define and set some statements around protecting funding for young children. And so because the council isn't an official boards or commission, and we don't have the state representatives don't have a voting role on it, these two subcommittees really felt like this was the primary focus of their work, and that's their work.
And follow up?
Go ahead, Representative Johnson.
So this is most, what we're seeing here is 3 years old. Is that correct? Because I've understood that this is still a very active group, and so we will be seeing what's happened over the last year. Is that correct?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Johnston. As I said, we do need to update our priorities. We haven't had time to do that at this point. All of our subcommittees need to work together to review whether these are the priorities for today. As today's moving forward, I think one of the things that's going to be really helpful to our subcommittees is to hear the presentations that are happening today and really go back and meet at their next meeting as we meet in 2018 to really define whether these are the accurate priorities. So we're very open to hearing whether or not these are the specific priorities that we should be setting. These were priorities and goals that they've been working on. Identify whether or not they've met goals in these areas. But you're correct. We do need to go back as subcommittees and identify whether this is the most timely work that we can do. And we would look for guidance from the legislature, guidance from community members, guidance from partners to say, this is what's important now, and these are where priorities should be. So what you're seeing is a representation of honestly old work that needs to be renewed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson and Ms. Galanos. Representative Sponholz, do you have a comment?
Yeah, I wanted to comment as I was looking at these subcommittee priorities. The first three seem to be me pretty clearly, you know, priorities, whereas the last two seem to be more strategies for achieving the other priorities. And I know that we've learned a lot about, you know, efficacy and how it is that you in management theory, how it is that you make sure that you really achieve outcomes. And one of the ways that you achieve outcomes is by not having too many goals and narrowing down in a small number of goals that you can focus all of your energy on. And it might be something to consider as the AECCC moves forward, sort of narrowing down the goals and identifying strategies for achieving those goals. You know, when I think about, you know, identifying and using community-based solutions to expand access to early childhood services, the public engagement and community partnerships, for example, sounds to me like a strategy for achieving all of the top three, right? That we're in a day and an age where no entity does the work alone. No state entity, no private entity walks alone. And so, you know, partnering to do that is really important. And then when I see also in the fourth one, innovation and long-term investment,
particularly as I'm thinking about using the braided funding opportunities, that's all about community partnerships and collaborating and, you know, identifying different ways that different organizations and funding entities can come together. And so that might be sort of, you know, something to think about as the AECCC moves forward and revisits its priorities. It might be something to consider sort of narrowing those down and separating out the priorities and the strategies a little bit.
I would hate to think of what it would look like if we also had the Labor and Commerce Committee and Public Safety, which I believe exists only as a budget subcommittee. But we do have and have had representatives of all those committees here at the table. So this is to me, this is really revealing in terms of the depth of inner working among all the departments. And I'm actually pleased that the council establishment called for adding labor and commerce and public safety. I think that's terrific. All right. Any further questions on Ms. Galanos' section?
Through the chair.
Go ahead.
I'd just like to add before, as you move forward and you think about the council, I think that it's important to understand the structure of the council and the limited ability that we've had to really engage in really hard work. The council's co-chaired by our commissioners who have a lot of other priorities. They are dedicated. They work hard for these councils. Both Commissioner Davidson and Commissioner Johnson have been very committed. You have two staff members who have full-time jobs within the state. So mm-hmm. as Becky Morrissey is sitting on the line, I can guarantee you she's probably trying to multitask with 32 other things. Mm-hmm. Right now in other states, there are setups that really do work to help refine, engage the legislature, engage the governor's office, mm-hmm. engage policymakers, and engage private agencies in continually providing updated priorities that serve and represent the needs of policymakers and can really be reflective of what the needs of children in our state are. And I will be perfectly honest in saying that this council has done the best that they can with what they've had. It's a very large council with a lot of people on it. It meets quarterly, and it's not always easy to turn this large ship and really focus the efforts when you have lots of programs with lots of competing priorities. Mm-hmm. So we look for help. We look for guidance. We'd look for a strengthened partnership with our policymakers. And we'd look for any suggestions that you have. This is your advisory council. This is the council that's here to tell you what the priorities are in the state from all people. How that's used and how you engage it and how our policymakers engage it should be something that we're all part of. And so rather than viewing it as completed work and consistent, I'd like it as I walk away to say, use it as a draft, a frame, a framework to say, what do we really need in our state as an advisory council, and what is the best way that we can get there, and who should serve on the advisory council? Who are the best representatives for this, and who's doing the work? And are these priorities, I completely respect the comments that these priorities may not be the right priorities for right now. Are they the ones that we need in Alaska? And as you hear the rest of the speeches and the presentations from our members, I would encourage you to think about that and encourage you to really think if this is what we need in our state right now and where should we go and how can we provide that advice to the advisory council so we can best serve policymakers.
Thank you, Angela. Truly appreciate that. Santa, do you have a comment? All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Next, we'll turn our attention to a presentation from Pat Sidmore. Mr. Sidmore, welcome. Put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
My name is Patrick Sidmore, and I am a health and social services planner with the Alaska Mental Health Board and the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, and I am the chairperson of the Data Committee for the AECCC, the Coordinating Council.
Go ahead, sir.
Okay. So when I was asked to do this, I you know, I started to think about it, and as the Alaska Mental Health Board and Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse are big consumers of data, because our job is to advise the legislature, the administration, as well as the Mental Health Trust. I thought I would talk about how we look at early childhood. We've had a focus on early childhood mental health for about 5 years. Our board members think this is really an important topic. And of course, mental health expands into education and physical health. It's all, you know, it's all linked together. I think as we age, we kind of separate that out and put it into different chunks. Mm-hmm. But really, when we think about an infant, health and mental health and everything is all right there. So this portion of the presentation is really about the fingers there, the data and the systems alignment. And I want to start, I guess, to maybe make it a little interesting. It's an early morning. I know you've all been working hard, with maybe a little quiz. And we'll answer these during the presentation. So given the nature that we're talking about early childhood, there's probably a hint to the answer to the first one. At what age are, in the U.S. are you most likely to be expelled from school? What percentage of children age 6 and under receive care by someone other than their parent or guardian? By age 8, what percentage of Alaska children have had a report of harm to OCS? What percentage of Alaska children at the start of kindergarten can regulate their feelings and emotions at an age-appropriate level? This is going to be a really important piece of the presentation today. And then what skills mitigate the health impact of trauma, childhood trauma, or toxic levels of stress? And it turns out there's a really good answer to that. So here's an outline. By training, I'm a social worker, but I also have a degree in economics. So I always like to start when I analyze things from an economic perspective. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the brain science and how that ties in. Then I'm going to show you some data sets, just a sample. There's a rich amount of data that we have. Of course, the work is how do we bring it together to tell the story of what's happening and use that information to make good decisions. And then finally, I'm going to talk about some things that are problems and then potential solutions to those. So some of you may have seen this before. This is a slide from James Heckman. He's a Nobel laureate from the University of Chicago Economics Department. I like the University of Chicago. Milton Friedman is, you know, a famous Nobel laureate from there, and I had one of his professors, or one of my professors did his dissertation under Milton Friedman, and I'll never forget the day he leaned forward and he said, "I'm going to give you the secret to making money." And we all leaned in and he said, "Buy low, sell high." Well, it turns out that works for kids too. We invest low and we get good outcomes. So this slide is James Heckman's work called the Heckman Equation. You can Google it. It's an interesting site. And this shows that as we invest in early child care, especially for disadvantaged children, we get a return on investment. There's a line that is often on this graph that isn't included in this, and it's a line that goes horizontally, and that's the line of the cutoff where by the more we invest, or what we invest, we get a bigger return back than what we've invested, and that really goes through the line of about third or fourth grade. So it's when we talk about early childhood, Angie was talking about 0 to 8, birth to 8. That's really that's the sweet spot, according to Dr. Heckman. So so why is that the sweet spot, I guess? And I think we have to go back to development. Brain development at this time is unbelievably dynamic. This is a slide from Dr. Linda Chamberlain, who was in public health for years here. She's an international speaker on childhood trauma and other things. But this slide is from some of her work. And the way to look at this is how we develop. When we're born, about 40% of our brain is wired up. And if you start at the bottom of this slide here on the left, you know, things like blood pressure regulation and heartbeat are all online. But slowly we move up and we're wiring constantly, and we're wiring enormous billions of connections in our brains each day, especially early on. And we're learning, and this is an incredibly adaptive way to grow a human being, because it's not all wired up. So we can actually grow human beings that are adapted to their environment. So if it's a really harsh environment, they're going to construct their brain is going to be constructed around that. If it's less so, anyway, we can construct the brains of our children through all of these interactions based on what they experience, and all the way up until about age 24, when we have abstract thought, right? That's where it kind of solidifies. Now, all that being said, we can change our brains at any time, and we do constantly. But there's this really, sweet spot early on where there's dynamic change, and if there are problems, we can fix them with less resources early on than later. But again, at any age, we can fix it. Oops, wrong way. So this is just another example. Representative Sponholz mentioned the pruning idea, and so the graphic on the left shows the neuron connections of a child at birth. And then we move to age 7, and the complexity is just overwhelming. And it turns out that at 7 years old, or at that age, at that, you know, middle childhood age, we can't really sustain that level of complexity. So at puberty, we have a big pruning. Mm-hmm. And what do we prune? We prune those things that we haven't used, okay? So this is important to think about what sort of experiences we want to give children, and this is what families want to do, right? And, I think it's really important, and you'll hear from me and Dr. Heckman throughout the presentation that really the secret is how do we support families, because families are doing this work, right? It's not the state. Yes.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking at the slides here, and it reminds me of my work when I worked at Providence Hospital in the prenatal unit, and in talking to some of the nurses there recently, they've had such a high number of drug-addicted moms that they've tried to work with so that they could, you know, babies could come to full term and be born. So just looking at this graph, do you have anything else that shows the correlation of the drug-addicted mothers and the effects on the babies, and how this wiring is in connection with that? Because what they're seeing is just an incredible number of babies in NICU now that are addicted babies.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative, I don't have any of that with me. For some of that, I rely on some of our experts, like it was mentioned, Dr. Matt Hirschfeld from the Pediatric Partnership. That's a great question. We could track some of that down and get back to you on that, because I think that's a very valid point. And it gets back to this idea too around fetal alcohol spectrum disorder.
Yes.
Any sort of exposure, and we'll talk a little bit later, another exposure that children can have is to stress hormones from their mothers. Mm-hmm. Which can be toxic as well. So,
thank you.
Yes.
Through the chair, just to follow up real quick.
Go ahead.
I'm just thinking that how the neurons would look on there, I'm sure, are going to be very different mm-hmm. for the babies that go through that. So, okay, thanks.
You're welcome. So, back to Dr. Heckman. So in his analysis, self-control, openness, and the ability to engage others, to plan and persist, these are the attributes that get people in the door and on the job and lead to productive lives. So we're going to talk about this concept. Sometimes he calls these the soft skills. Sometimes he calls these character skills. Sometimes I call them self-regulation skills, where we kind of manage our emotions and thoughts and, you know, stay engaged in the world. And I wanted to point out, again, as we think about this brain building that's happening and what we can do to make sure families have what they need, and, you know, that goes from sometimes interventions and health, but it's also good jobs for their parents and you know, childcare if that's what they need. But anyway, again, back to this idea of self-regulation. So the Administration on Children and Families, the federal administration, asked Duke University to look into all the research, and they looked at, I believe, about 400 studies. And the task was, if we could build one thing into all our programs that would actually help, what would that be? And they came back with self-regulation. And we'll talk more about defining it. But again, it's really this idea of managing yourself. And Heckman talks about how important that is to get a job and keep it. And I think these points up here are really important. You know, it's foundational. It's emotions and thinking. It's both, there's biology involved in it. External factors like environment, you know, all that plays in. It can be taught, and it can be taught at any age. I was just at the recidivism conference yesterday, and we were talking about building that in adults, because sometimes it didn't happen. And then there's this idea of co-regulation. And co-regulation is really how we learn to self-regulate, right? I was at a conference the other day, and someone yelled over my shoulder. They said, "Pat, you have a baby." And I said, well, and I turned around, and indeed I did. And why did they know I had a baby? I was doing this, right? I was bouncing. Baby was a little fussy, and I was co-regulating with the baby. This is how babies learn to co-regulate. This is how children learn when they're upset and we sit down and are calm and work through it with them. That's how they learn to self-regulate. So this is really important. There's some interesting work going on that Angie started with the Department of Education and Early Development and with THRED and our boards and AEYC about helping child care workers and preschool teachers learn these skills, because it's really important. And we'll talk some more about that. So who are we talking about? So I went out to the Department of Labor website, and it turns out 95,000 kids are from birth to age 8 in this 2007. To give you a little frame of reference, that's about the same number as the 65-plus population. That actually surprised me. I didn't think it would be that close. This is where they live. This is birth to 9. I didn't ask for the data to be cut precisely to 0 to 8, but this was available. So it gives you an idea of the percentage of where kids live. It's interesting that some census areas in the state have 20% of their population is in this range, and all the way down to about 5%. So moving on to how do we start to look at what's going on with these children and their families. And so there are many data sources. This is not an exhaustive list, but I wanted to highlight some of them. PRAMS, Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System, is a survey that's done right after the birth of a child. And it asks about what went on prenatally during the birth, you know, process, and then in infancy that first year. There's CUBS, which is Child Understanding Behavior Survey, which is a follow-up that's done at 3 years old, and that has some interesting work. We've got some work that our boards have done around adverse childhood experiences that might be interesting. We don't have a lot of that built in here, The Department of Education, at age five, there's a developmental profile done on children when they enter kindergarten. We'll show a little bit of those slides today and talk about that. The CDC has slides. The council has put out reports. There's work from Yale. I'm sorry.
One question from Representative Johnson.
I was just wondering, as far as the prams and the cubs, are those voluntary?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, yes, they are.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead, Mr. Sidmore.
Okay. Thank you. So I want to point out in the middle of this graphic is the AKA IBIS. And for your staff and for yourselves and for people in Alaska, if you haven't seen this, I'd be happy to show you or have the people from Public Health who developed this show it to you. It's fascinating. You can actually query cubs and prams and our high school students and OCS data and actually do some cross-tabulation demographically or regionally. It's very interesting information. And it's fairly accessible. We use this a lot so that we don't necessarily have to take up the time of public health to run queries for us. We use the information, and I'll show you some of it. But I want to start with prams just to give you an idea of what's available. What are the data sources in prams? And, again, this is that prenatal, birth, and infancy. So it's a survey of moms, you know, in that first year of life for children. So you can see from this list some of the things that you can find in prams about what's going on for them.
I'd like to note that Senator Tom Begich has poked his head in the room. As a member of Senate Education, I'm sure he'd love to be part of this group. You're welcome to join us.
So you can see you've got things from what's going on with the mother's health, behavioral health during this time, potential exposure to violence, all sorts of different things that can be used in behavioral health or health to look at how prevention programs are going or not, et cetera. And so the next slide, then, this is during pregnancy. So what sort of things were going on? You know, did a healthcare provider really talk to you about this topic or that topic? You can look and find out, again, online what's going on. And then finally, after pregnancy, for the mom, and then what's happening for the child. Lots of data points. So as the chair of the data committee for the AECCC, what we're really looking at is how can we tell the story of early childhood without just this big list of going through and putting out a lot of data points. And we're working on that. We've got an intern that's helping us think about that, to put it together, and it's early, but we really think that if we get to where we want to be, we're going to have a product that will help you and help us to be smarter, to look at what works and what doesn't. So back to James Heckman's, we're going to talk about prenatal programs or data. So here's an example. This is taken from the IBIS, which is the searchable data system on the public health website. And this is about smoking. We know that moms who smoke, their children are at risk of a lot of different things. And it turns out that about over a several-year period, about 14%. And I went back and, you know, applied that 14% there at the bottom of the slide. And out of those 95,000 kids, we would estimate that about 13,500 of those kids' moms smoked during pregnancy. So there are efforts, of course, to prevent smoking, and so this is a way to monitor it. As you can see, this is over some time, maybe we're starting to see a trend, a downward trend, but it's not statistically there yet. Mm-hmm. But it's a way to monitor. These are questions that I actually asked to have run from Public Health, and Dr. Jared Parrish sent these to me. And there are several questions about interpersonal violence or domestic violence. And what we found was that about 7.5% of the women surveyed had experienced one of these. So again, that's 7,000 children that we would think that had experienced that, or their mother had experienced that either before, during, or after pregnancy. So why do we talk about interpersonal violence? So when I started to ask the experts about what they thought I should say, again, Matt Hirschfeld wanted me to make sure I brought this topic up. So epigenetics, and I was a liberal arts major, so please don't ask me to explain the chemistry behind this. But Matt could. He has a PhD in biochemistry. So epigenetics is this idea that, so we have cells in our body, and they have our full genetic code in them, right? So I have a cell here that's a skin cell, and it has my full genetic code. And then inside my heart, I have a heart cell that has my full genetic code. Well, why is this a skin cell and that one is a heart cell? Well, there's this biochemical, for lack of a better term, switch that lays over our genes, and those switches determine what happens to our cells. And those are impacted profoundly by our environment. This is why if we eat poorly, we may eventually get cancer. It's not guaranteed, of course. I mean, there's a baseline genetic to it. But those switches can get turned on, and stress is one of the biggest ways they can get turned on. And those can be inherited. So a mother who is stressed can pass those switched on genes for health problems to their children. Now, those can be reversed, so that's a good sign. But this field is fascinating, and it's one we need to be aware of. So stress is a very important part of what we need to look at in terms of supporting families. Okay, now we're going to move on beyond the prenatal to those first few years. So I just pulled a couple, and these are from the Alaska Cubs Survey, or Child Understanding Behavior Survey. The first one is breastfeeding. And so this is asking mothers of three-year-olds, you know, whether or not they breastfed their children. And by the way, Alaska does amazingly well compared to the rest of the states in this. We do a great job. It's never going to be 100% because sometimes there are health issues, and that's okay. But we know that breastfeeding has incredible health benefits for the child and for the mother. And so this is a way to monitor that, and there are efforts to boost breastfeeding beginning in hospitals. And then the second measure here is drinking soda. And these are three-year-olds, and so about 17% of our children are drinking soda at three. When we think about some of the dental costs that we have in the state, we're laying the groundwork. And again, think about the brain wiring that's happening here, about having sugar. This is important.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you. I just want to point out, it's not just soda. You've got apple juice, orange juice, any sugar drink. That, like, I grew up with Tang. Sorry, but I did. And but anyway, nowadays, no soda, no none of that. And so it's milk or water, it seems, right, for my grandkids.
Yeah.
So I'm learning. But does that sound right then? Not just soda, but other sugar drinks?
Yes, through the chair, absolutely right. And there's actually a measure for other sugar drinks as well. So, yeah.
The Dental Society in Anchorage gave a presentation to me and other school board members in the 90s and showed us photos of airplanes packed with soda being flown out to rural communities. They showed us photos of children's, of babies' mouths with teeth emerging rotten from this kind of feeding. It's frightening. Representative Zolkowski.
I think if we can partner with some of our community leaders to make water and other sources of healthy fluids for our young children less expensive than some of these sugary drinks that are so much less expensive mm-hmm. and sold at a lot lower rates than it costs to buy a bottle of water, then maybe we wouldn't see the disparity that we see.
Mm. Excellent point. All right.
Thank you. So I guess I covered this, but there are obviously benefits to breastfeeding, to encouraging that when it's possible, and just supporting families in making that work. And obviously we've talked about reducing soda consumption. So again, back to Dr. Heckman. Again, it's about supporting families. So how can we do things like have good water to make those things available. So I wanted to do one more Cubs measure. So again, three-year-olds, and this is related to reading with the children. So we start to think about school readiness. Obviously, school readiness starts before age three, but this is a measure that we have. I think about the Imagination Library that Best Beginnings has going in the state. I was just talking about that at the airport last night. How do we support families to do this, because that helps kids be ready for school? And so you get a sense from this what mothers are reporting, primarily mothers, are reporting about reading with their children. Okay, I'm going to move on to preschool programs. So this comes from the early care and learning, the economics of early care and learning in Alaska, put out by the council a couple years ago. And you can see that obviously families who are working need child care. And these are some results from that work. Looking at the bottom right hand corner with the donut graph, 46% of parents with children under age six report it was either very difficult or difficult to find childcare. Mm-hmm. Okay. This impacts our economy. And that 55% of children under age six receive care from someone other than their family members. So I think this is an industry that is big. 6,500 workers directly in childcare in the state. So it's not an insignificant industry. Another snapshot, I thought this was just interesting. This is, again, three-year-olds. Let me go back. Kids, 55% of children, six and under, were using childcare outside the home. But at three, this is a little different snapshot. At three, it's, 28.5%, and different regionally.
Just a question. That 6,500 workers directly in childcare, that's a really interesting number, and that's up to age six, generally.
The child care workers. That's
the pre-kindergarten.
Yes.
Okay. My brain is trying to figure out how that relates to the number of school-age children personnel in the K-12 right. system. There's about 22,000, including teachers and all sorts of supports, teachers through administration. That is absolutely fascinating. Thank you. And that includes the private sector,
yes.
As well as the public sector, Head Start, so on. Okay, thank you.
Estimate, yes.
Okay.
Stephanie Berglund from Thread told me an interesting story that if a child is in, you know, in childcare, you know, kind of from the start to the time they go to school, that they'll actually spend more time in childcare than they will in public education.
That's true. Yeah.
Because
many
it's a
hours,
long day.
Many more hours per day. Absolutely.
Year round. Okay. So Heckman's equation, a couple different analyses he's done too. This is the strongest 13% return on investment if we do quality child care for disadvantaged children. Quality is important. It doesn't hold up if it's not very good. An earlier one, just a little more pessimistic return, an earlier study he did was a 7 to 10% return on investment. Still not bad. So I started with that question at the beginning about the age at which you're most likely to be expelled in the United States from school. It's 4. You're most likely to be expelled at 4.
Wow.
This gives you the rates.
Self-regulation.
The rates by different ages.
Lack of self-regulation. Go back to that. Wow. That's incredible.
Right.
That is incredible.
This is work.
I think we're in shock. Representative Johnson.
I'm not. My children were expelled.
Anyone else have a confession to make?
And they're fine.
That's right. They let you come down here. They're fine.
No confessions here, but I'm curious what it is that we would be expelling four-year-olds for. Is that a question that you feel confident you can answer?
You want me to answer?
Go ahead, Representative Johnston, if you have an idea.
Our eldest was expelled because he did not want to participate. So he crawled under the table and basically sat there. Our second one was expelled because he crawled under the table and brought everybody under the table with him.
Did they get expelled too?
Our third one was a bouncy rabbit. And she just was so high energy that I have to say all three are quite successful adults.
Just say.
Representative Spotholz.
So perhaps to follow up on Representative Johnston's comments, is it fair to say that four-year-olds are being expelled for non-conforming behavior, not necessarily violent or unsafe behavior?
Through the chair, I think I'll expand on it a little bit with some more slides, but I think the answer is probably yes to all of it. So we really think it's about the adults and their preparation to handle the range of behavior that children have, right? Mm-hmm. So there's some interesting, this is all work by Walter Gilliam, he's in Yale, and the Department of Ed and Thread and AEYC and our boards, we're about to do a survey of early childhood. So to get a handle on this in our state. Mm-hmm. So these are pre-K expulsion rates by state. This is just pre-K.
Wow.
Okay. You can see we're in the middle of the range. So again, you know, this is the numbers are small, so you know it's. You know, it may be a little hard to compare, but it's interesting to look at and to think about the implications. So here are some different characteristics of the child care centers and their expulsion rates. So child teacher ratio, program length of day has an impact. The big one sitting in the left-hand corner is teacher job stress. And when we heard Walter Gilliam, who's been to the state, when we heard him say, you know, it turns out if your child care worker isn't depressed, you're probably going to be okay. You're probably not going to get expelled. So it gets to what sort of supports are there for that worker? Mm-hmm. Because once you expel or, and sometimes it's not, sometimes it's not really clear. It's not like, don't bring your kid. It's like, could you just bring them a little late tomorrow? Or could you come in the middle of the day and pick them up? And that starts to impact work for parents. So a soft expulsion can occur that doesn't even really register on any sort of measure. So that's some of what our survey is, not my survey, what the work of THREAD and DEED is doing. There's some bias. This was done, there's some bias, and 4-year-olds are more likely to be expelled than 3-year-olds, and they think this is about size. So when you're throwing yourself around and you're 3, it's a little more manageable than when you're 4. African-American students, when compared to white students, they did some interesting looking at basically 4-year-old actors, if you can imagine, at a table. They asked preschool teachers to watch for something wrong, and then they had technology to see where their eyes went. And overwhelmingly, they went to minorities, first boys, then girls, boys and girls. Wow. So it was interesting, something to think about. And then, of course, boys are much more likely to be expelled. So one of the questions on the quiz at the beginning was related to kindergartners and their self-regulation skills, their ability to manage their emotions. And I'll give you that answer right now. 45% of, 45.5, I think, of our children at kindergarten are on track emotionally to do that. And this comes from the developmental profile that's done for kindergartners in the first 4 weeks of school. Their teachers assess them on 13 things, gross motor skills, fine motor skills, their knowledge of the alphabet, you know, things like that. And these results show that 17% hit all of those 13. They've got them all. 69 have left fewer than 11 of those. So we're going to move again into schooling. This is from that same study of the economics of early care and learning. Of course, children, when they go to school, they still need after-school care. If their parents are working. So this helps to explain how parents deal with that. Again, on the right, bottom right-hand corner, about 28% of parents reported that it's hard to, or difficult or very difficult to find that care. And you can see across the top where children are going, how parents are dealing with. And then 42% of kids are in care of non-family members at this age. So kind of bringing the good doctor back in, programs that work, supplement family life, they start early, they're quality. They don't replace the family, they support them. So I want to kind of look at a broad picture of the whole age span. And some of you I know have seen this. This is the work of Dr. Jared Parrish. He's an epidemiologist for our state. I will say that as a consumer of data, as a state employee, and even before state employee since 2001, this is the best data set I've ever seen. this has the most potential to be useful. So what Dr. Parrish has done is he has taken that PRAMS data, that pregnancy risk monitoring, that prenatal data, and he has followed a cohort of children from the 2009, 10, and 11 group. That's 3,500 children. And he has linked that data with OCS data. And the other thing he's linked that data to is the permanent fund. So when a child leaves the state, we know that they've left the state, and we remove them from the data set. No other state has that ability, so our data is very solid. So we start with what we know about children and reports of harm. And this is 0 to 17. So you can see substantiated reports of harm screened in. So what he's done is he's linked that data, those children that are now 8 years old, to OCS data and reports of harm. And what we find is that 32% of our 8-year-olds, based on this sample, and I will say it's a very good sample. I mean, it's representative. It's large enough. The 32% of our children have had a report of harm by age 8. When we think back to that 95,000 that's in that group, that means 30,000. 10% have had that substantiated.
Can you tell us what screened in means? What's the difference between a report and substantiated?
Hopefully I won't upset my friends at OCS. I think I can explain it. So the report is just that. A report came to OCS from mm-hmm. someone that there's an issue. Mm-hmm. Screened in means that it was initially investigated enough to determine that an investigation needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And then the investigation is done, and then substantiated means that there is a report of harm filed. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I have several questions. Representative Parrish and then Johnson.
I won't ask you to answer this, but for our friends over at OCS, if they could get the committee and or me an estimate of the proportion of false positives and false negatives, that would be interesting.
Representative Johnson.
I think I'm aware that OCS has a 1-3 as far as the reporting in. And it would be interesting to get how many children that, I can't remember which way it goes, is 3, they have to do it immediately, and 1 is, yeah. How many are 3s, how many are 1s, how many days they have to report or to investigate, or what's the time limit for 3, 2, and 1, and then how many 2 and 1s eventually become into that 10%.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the reason I think that this data set is so incredible is because of this linkage. Remember when we went through those 3 slides of PRAM questions that we have? So those moms, when they took the PRAM survey, signed a release that data could be linked. Okay, and so what Dr. Parrish has been able to do is he's been able to look at the questions they answered about, for example, prenatal issues going on, positive and negative, in their lives, and then link it to whether or not there are OCS outcomes. Kind of jumped ahead of myself a little here, but this is an example of on the left, 10% a year. We know those kids have a report, but cumulatively, that's the big issue, 32%, and then we know from the adult ACE study that 34% of adults reported this. So it's actually interesting. It's going to be interesting to see if that cohort continues, and again, we're only looking at first reports of harm, whether we're going to see that rise in the same way as it did with this group. You can see it rises quickly at a young age, and this is in line with other data that we've looked at our boards, that adverse childhood experiences are front-loaded. So adverse childhood experiences are based on from birth to 18, but what we found in our analysis, at least at national data, and Alaska was similar too, was that 50% of the ACEs that were going to occur in a population occurred by age 3. So again, it's front-loaded. So what Dr. Parrish is able to do is go back and look at what mothers reported they experienced prenatally, and as it turns out, much like the ACE work, the more problems prenatally, the more likely it was for a report of harm. And he can actually dig into which ones are more likely to lead to a report of harm as well in the data.
Okay, Mr. Sidmore. We are starting to run tight on time.
Yep.
So I hate to ask you to talk faster because this is absolutely critical information.
I have teenagers, I can do it.
All right.
So how do we use this data? Alcan data shows us that we've got kids front-loaded. So this data, as the Division of Behavioral Health was looking at what can we do, and the Commissioner's Office, what can we do in our 1115 waiver for behavioral health, we need to be upstream. We need to be serving those children at 2 and 1 and 3, mm-hmm. which we can't do in our current system because of the way it's set up around severe emotional disturbance. It's hard to diagnose a child that young with a severe emotional disturbance. But because the waiver allows states to waive the rules, and there are some mechanisms to get to this, we can actually bring in some federal money to help get in and fix these things earlier. So that's how this data can be used and has been used. Again, remember back wired up, wired down. We're developing and then we prune. I want to talk about stress. Three kinds of stress. There's positive stress, right? That's what I felt just before I had to come up here and talk, right? Hopefully it boosted my performance a little. That time will tell, or my colleagues will tell me. There's tolerable stress. Okay, bad things happen to us, but if we are wrapped in a community and a family that supports us, we're going to get through it and it may make us stronger. And then there's toxic stress. And toxic stress is often when the people who are supposed to protect us don't. And so we are, as we talked earlier, a child is inundated with stress hormones, much like toxins of alcohol or other substances, and that changes the brain. Josh Arvidson from the Alaska Child Trauma Center here in Alaska, who is a national, international expert. By the way, we have a world-class trauma center in Anchorage. I just want to put in a plug for that. Amazing people. He has these next three slides that I think explain it well. When children have been exposed to toxic stress, this is how we normally operate. We kind of go through life. We're taking in our senses. We're making plans. We're acting on them, you know, and we move down the road. If we are on Perseverance Trail here in Juneau or out in the valley somewhere on a hike and we run into a bear or a moose, we've got this alarm system that kicks in, right? We can go into fight, flight, or freeze mode. This gets us out of danger. We're not thinking, my gosh, that's a large land mammal. History has shown, no, we don't do that, do we? We get out of there, or we freeze and hide, or whatever. This is really a great thing. If we have been exposed to toxic stress, that off-ramp is the road. So going back to a child care setting, time to go outside. Everybody goes to their cubby, gets their boots on. It's a swarm, right? somebody inevitably trips while they're trying to put on their boots, and they run into the kid whose alarm system is this, what is the response? That's how you get kicked out of child care, if the teachers don't understand. Right? They're going to get pushed. The kid's going to shut down. They're going to run away. One of those things. Self-control, openness. You've seen this slide before. Self-regulation. You've seen this one. These are the things we can do. We can get in there. It matters that children have self-regulation. So again, this is national data, that some analysis that we've done. The National Survey of Children's Health, we took the data set, it's 94,000, and we looked at three things. We looked at a health measure, which was functional, not based on diagnoses. We looked at trauma, which was an ACE score. And we looked at self-regulation, these three things. Can they finish a task? Can they stay calm when facing a challenge? And are they engaged in the world? By the way, those three questions, almost word for word, are on the developmental profile that we asked. This is the way to read this chart. So let's look at the three columns on the left. Those are the kids with zero ACEs, okay? That's what the zero is underneath. The score, the columns going up, the higher the column is, the worse their health is. Okay? Tracking. So what, and then the colors are about their self-regulation. If they're green, they've got all three of those self-regulation scores. And you can see if those kids with zero trauma, if they've got all self-regulation scores, their health is better. Right? But here's the interesting thing. Let's go over to the 4+. We see the same sort of dynamic in the 4+ trauma score kids. But look at the column all the way to the left, and the health is 0.71 for the zero ACEs, right? So that's a high level of poor health. And compare that to the kids with four ACEs all the way to the right, but they have all the self-regulation scores. They have better health than the kids with no trauma. You drop self-regulation between trauma and poor outcomes, you change the outcomes. Now, this is not easy. This is not easy for traumatized kids. This is why child care workers, teachers, parents need to have support in doing that work, especially for traumatized kids. And by the way, if you've ever had a 2-year-old trying to help them self-regulate, we all need a little help.
Yeah.
So here are the answers to those questions where we started. 4 years old is the age at which you're most likely to be expelled. 55% of the children 6 and under receive care outside the home. First report of harm, birth to 8, 32% or 30,000 kids. What percentage of Alaska children start at the start of kindergarten can regulate their feelings and impulses, 45. And then what skills can mitigate the impact of trauma, self-regulation skills. I want to say that the Department of Health and Social Services, Department of Education, and Public Safety got together in 2015. They put together this document. It's available. You can see their priorities, and their focus was on early intervention. And so that's readable. And I guess at this point, hopefully, I got us under the wire, Representative Drummond.
Wow. I know we could ask questions for hours, but we're going to not. If you have questions for Mr. Sidmore, we still have two more sessions, and we can bring up some questions at that point in time. Okay, thank you so much. That was, I had no idea. I had no idea. All right. Trevor, come. I know you can talk fast. I think we all know Trevor Storrs, and he will put himself on the record and begin his presentation.
Good morning, everybody. Trevor Storrs with the Alaska Children's Trust. I'm the executive director, and thank you for this opportunity. It's always definitely hard to follow Pat and the amazing information that he shares. Ours is going to be around kids count and the most recent report that was released on economic well-being of our families. Of course, the focus of the Children's Trust is on the prevention of child abuse and neglect. But one of our programs is Voices for Alaska's Children. And within that is the Kids Count. And the whole idea of Kids Count is the collection of data that is throughout very much of what Pat was sharing and trying to take what's focused in and around children and families and put it in one easy location. And also do some analysis of that data and also provide recommendations. So today we'll be sharing about that report. The data that will be shared is from various sources, very similar to, again, what Pat Sidmore shared. We do want to specifically thank the team at the Annie E. Casey Foundation who supports the Kids Count and some of the other funders, Population Reference Bureau, and specifically DHSS. We work very close with them, and they actually maintain a data center that we're required to manage through the Kids Count program. And so many of the sources that they have then feed into that. And also we want to thank our advisory committee that helps review this and put the report together. So I have to press the button here, not just my own computer. Two buttons to press.
Oh, dear.
So resilient family. If we think about a teeter-totter, so when a family has that employment, they have education, they have access to health services, all those supports, you have a teeter that when the amount of that and the intensity of those type of protective factors and resources, they outweigh the amount and intensity of risk factors. Again, much of the risk factors that were shared just earlier. And then we have that resilient family. And when a family has these protective factors and resources, it helps them to ensure that children are growing up in those safe, stable environments. Now, one of those key elements, which we're going to be talking about today, is economics. Research shows that a family who do not have economic stability are at greater risk of experiencing trauma, like child abuse and neglect, and many of the other things that we know about that exist in our society today. So it will be helpful to look at who we're talking about. And again, you saw some of this in Pat's slides. 25% of our population is children, and we're talking 0 to 17. And you see the breakup that from 0 to 4, 5 to 11, and so forth. And nearly 40% of those children live in Anchorage. And again, you see that breakout of where the kids are living. Income is not equal. This slide shows that the median family income here in Alaska is approximately $75,000. But what's really important is take out the white population. And when you do that, that median drops by nearly $30,000. It becomes $48,000 and some change. It's a huge difference. And when you look across that, you can see which communities of color are most impacted. Families of color, what this slide is showing, is still struggles to obtain the same opportunities as white families. And obviously, economics really play a strong part and role, specifically around accessing services, whether it is having the resources to purchase them, or to be able to get to them, or even at times to even know about them. About two-thirds of our kids live with two parents.
Hold on a second, Trevor.
Yes.
Representative Kopp has a question.
Thank you. Madam, back a slide there, Trevor, please.
Absolutely.
Thank you, through the chair. Trevor, one of the things about a slide like this that does not accurately portray Alaskans, we're showing Alaska Native American Indian income down 31.9 below the median. So we have to remember that many of our first Alaskan communities are on more of a cash economy, more of a subsistence. And the way, you know, our maybe living and working in town, your cash flow can put you in a different economic position because you have to have that for the number of bills that require just because you are in town. Having grown up in villages, I can tell you that the cash economy is not exactly the same as when you're living in town. And many of my neighbors in New Halen and Iliamna growing up were not considered themselves poor at all, but they just the subsistence lifestyle isn't conducive to this kind of a chart indicating poverty or disparity of income, because it's not equivalent to someone maybe living on the road system. It is kind of an apples and oranges comparison. I just wanted to point that out. Sometimes we can, these charts can indicate that everybody is in the same environment, but all these people are not in the same environment. If they were all in the same environment, then I would say that it was probably, would be the difference for from a median would be a more relevant argument. But I think particularly with some of our groups in Alaska, it's not exactly a direct comparison. I just wanted to note that.
Thank you, Representative Kopp.
And through the chair, I would absolutely agree that people live in different environments, and if we could break it down by regions and so forth, then there's probably further information that we could provide on that. You're absolutely right. What this does is just does provide a picture, and when we also think about many of the services, some of the solutions that we're going to be talking about and that you've been looking at, unfortunately, those services through that kind of subsistence living don't take a hide of moose to be able to cover child care, things of that nature. So this does provide us at least of a base of conversation. Is it exact? No data is. But it does provide at least a snapshot for the conversation that's needed. And that's the idea of this. But I do agree. Thank you. All right. So as mentioned here, two-thirds of our kids live with two parents. And the remaining 60,000 actually live with one parent, and of those, 70% are with moms. And this will be very important when we get into understanding some different costs out there and how this plays out of the stressors that being a single household can have within a family in the sense of accessibility to resources. We also know that many parents who have a job are unable to find regular full-time employment that pays a living wage. In 2015, over one-third of Alaska's children live in families where no parent has regular full-time employment. That's approximately 64,000 children. And again, kind of back to that original slide and what that's been shared, if people don't have the resources, the actual cash, to be able to exchange for the services they need, whether we're talking health care for mental health, treatment, access to daycare, preschool, all those things, it can have a great impact on the development of the child and the overall needs of the family, which you'll see further on. And when the family units shift through marriage, divorce, separation, new children, there are often profound economic consequences for children in the home. Children growing up in single-parent families typically do not have access to those same economic resources as we talked about, and those stressors then can lead to traumas that are more toxic. So where you live has that big impact on how much families struggle. And maybe this is getting a little bit to what Representative Kopp was talking about a little bit. Again, it doesn't necessarily pull in the subsistence side of things, but it does show the number the children who live in families with incomes below the federal poverty level in specific regions. Of course, we can only do by regions. We don't get into the small community sizes. It's too difficult. And just do the data. So the number of children, and then you look at the percentage. So overall, we know approximately over 25,000 of our children here in Alaska are living below that poverty level between 2011 and 2015.
Trevor, what's the age range of those 26,000 children up to age?
I would have to go back. Unfortunately, all the data sources don't follow the same age ranges. Mm-hmm. So I would have to look back. Mm-hmm. I do not know off the top of my head. However, it's either 0 to 17, 18, or 19. It's one of those. It depends on the source. They all define children okay. a little differently.
But it does include
at least from 0 to 17, 18, or 19.
So it includes the K-12 population
yes.
as well as the preschool.
Yes.
Okay, great.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Good question for clarity here. So when you talk about the federal poverty level, are you pulling from the income level that you had in the previous slide at $75,500?
So,
what are we looking at?
So poverty levels for a family, so like poverty level for a family of two is $16,240. Mm-hmm. For three, it's $20,000. 420, so this is based off the federal poverty levels.
Very good. That's a huge difference. Thank mm-hmm. you.
I'm actually going to do these a little bit out of order because this slide, after looking at it, made a little more sense before the next one and I'll return. So talking about income, a really good indicator of the impact of economic stability or well-being is housing. So this is from the National Low Income Housing Coalition, and you will see in Alaska that a household has to be earning $24.10 per hour to be able to afford a two-bedroom at fair market rate. Fair market rate is determined, again, by federal standards. And this is also to work just 40 hours. So that may be one individual needs to be at least working earning that $24.10, or if it's two adults or three adults, whatever their total income, it needs to be $24.10. And then to your right, you start seeing that amount actually starts increasing. Definitely when you leave that urban center of Anchorage, you will start seeing that cost or that amount increase. Yeah. To be able to afford that housing. So to put that into perspective, so when you look here, you have approximately a minimum wage of $9.80 per hour. You have to work at least 77 hours each week. So basically, you're probably a legislator. You have to work those 77 hours per week to be able to afford just that one bedroom. Even if you have two incomes coming in for that two-bedroom at minimum wage, or as we've known, Walmart, many of our retails are doing $10 or $11 an hour, so it is above minimum wage, when you add those together, it's still below that $24.10. Or depending on which community you live, it's definitely even further below. We know that the average rent wage here in Alaska is actually $19.11. So they're continually paying more. And it's standard that if you are paying 30% or less towards your housing, you're in a better economic stability position. When you're paying over that 30%, you're in jeopardy. And again, be thinking about that teeter-totter. Things are moving over. It's no longer a resilient when you're continually figuring out, can I afford rent? And how do I buy all these, the food, all those basics, you start having huge pressure put onto the family. Food is another big piece. So in 2014, 20% of all children, which is approximately nearly 38,000, live in households where there was not enough food because of insufficient resources. And again, think of that pressure on a family when you can't feed your children. And you have probably heard definitely those in the education committee, and the importance of food and how that plays into the ability of a child being able to learn. Mm-hmm. All of us, when we have that low blood sugar and we haven't eaten, that's why we made sure we ate this morning, so I was at least awake after getting in at 1 a.m. because of the delay with the flight. 2015, 81,000 individuals participated in that in our Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, SNAP. It's a key program that helps ensure our most vulnerable families have and children have access to that food. Transportation. As much as we try for public transportation, it's very limited. and just the way Alaska is designed. So 10% of our children, again, approximately nearly 19,000, live in homes where there was not a vehicle available for household members. Regionally, particularly off-the-road system, individuals may have less need for a truck or car or rather rely on ATVs. So we get that that also plays into the math. But when you're in those urban settings, you're greatly dependent on reliable transportation to get to these jobs that only pay $11. And when that car breaks down, then you're in, do I pay for the car to get to work? Or do I pay my rent and hold on to my housing and then potentially lose my job because I don't have reliable transportation and then lose your housing? It's not a win-win situation. And again, that puts further stress onto the family. This comes from that economic impact of early care and learning in Alaska through the AECCC in 15. So this shows that the majority of Alaska's early care and learning sector accounts, again, for that $430 million in annual spending, and the majority of that comes directly from a household, from their resources. Only $84 million come from federal grants, and you can see. Wow. So again, it's the family who's paying for this. But all the previous slides are showing a high number of our families don't have the resources to pay for this. So without subsidies or other assistance, whether we're talking on the housing, the food, childcare, et cetera, they would not have the resources to be able to ensure that their children have access to those very needed services that Pat Sidmore and many others have been talking about.
Madam Chair. Representative Tarr, go ahead.
On that previous slide, please. I'm just curious if you take into account, because it wouldn't be considered traditional learning environments necessarily, but some of the things that happen outside of schools, because that creates an even bigger achievement gap and further disadvantages lower-income students. So some of the extracurricular activities may be related to music or to athletics or to languages, things like that, that don't fall into traditional, are those considered other learning programs, or is this just more the traditional?
Unfortunately, THREAD is not here. I would actually look to them, or maybe Angie with AECC.
You know? Okay.
We'd have to look back.
Okay.
It's most likely more like the traditional, mm-hmm. but those things also play a huge factor. We're talking after-school type programs.
Right.
And those are very key throughout a kid's life. And again, especially as the child ages, those costs really do increase. And they play a huge role in which we'll see here very soon of making sure that our families, breadwinners, can still be working.
And Madam Chair, I just wanted to point that out because we have a bill under consideration that would help expand after-school programs. So I just wanted us to be thinking about that kind of investment. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Tarr. I appreciate that you pointed that out. This is definitely worth pursuing.
Right. And my apologies. I should have said through the chair.
That's all right.
I know you all so well
That's
sometimes.
Okay.
All right. Alaska is the top, is in the top 10, actually number 9, of the least affordable state for toddler care. Prohibitive, expensive child care limits parents' ability to enter the workforce. So that's a huge barrier. And definitely, potentially when THREAD does speak and or if anybody's had the chance to talk with them, you just know that a continual thing throughout the state is there's a huge demand and need for quality child care and after-school programming. So imagine those families that aren't making enough, unsure about their food security, unsure about their housing security, which then puts their employment at risk. All these things that had that resilient family is now shifting. And as you can see, that family is under that weight, trying to figure out how to manage all that. And I use the analogy of an elastic, because we keep looking at these families, and we always think, who would ever not ensure that their children are safe and in a stable, nurturing environment? Whoever would ever want to abuse their child? We truly believe that nobody wants to abuse their child. However, it's like an elastic band. Each one of those is a tug on that. And finally, that one last tug breaks that band, and somebody gets hit. If you've ever snapped an elastic band, you get hit. That's the analogy. That's what you are seeing here. So how do we change that, and how does that relate to early childhood supports? So we're going to focus in on that, because all of these things, there are solutions to all of this, which includes that early investment in early childhood supports, after-school programming, affordable housing, living wage, equal pay and compensation. We know that women are earning less, and in a single family, 70% of them are headed by women, and probably a good majority of them, I'd have to find the statistic, are probably not getting outside support from their other parent. Food security as well as health care. But today, the focus is on early childhood development. You've seen this slide. I'm not going to go through it. Pat did a fabulous job. This report, the economic impact of early care and learning in Alaska, does a really good job of summing up of why we should be investing in early childhood development. Whether we're talking why we think children should be healthy and or on an economic basis, they look at the whole child in all of the reasons. So we know that early childhood doesn't just build a good kid, it relates to many of the things that we are dealing with as a society today. So whether we're talking decreasing crime, improved graduation rates, teenage birth drops, increased employment, decreased welfare and health care costs, academic and earnings outcomes, and increased workforce. To get to some specifics, studies demonstrate pre-elementary programs can result in fewer juvenile and lifetime arrests for program participants. By reducing crime, early childhood education lowers crime justice system and victimization costs. We're talking about a $3 billion deficit being filled. You guys have a lot of decisions to make as legislators, but by investing in early childhood development, you're setting up a plan that hopefully minimizes the need to talk about that $3 billion deficit again in another 5 to 10 years. It's the same as our retirement. We've learned that. You can't afford to put $500 or $2 million in an account at the age of 65. So you start doing $25 today, and over time, it equals that $2 million. This is that same concept. So social savings from crime reductions associated with completing secondary education show a 1% increase in high school graduation rates, which yields a $1.8 billion in social benefits. That's a U.S. number.
Representative Zilkowski has a question.
Thank you so much. So I just want to make sure that I followed. So if you could just indulge.
Absolutely.
Being recently sitting with this committee. So the nuts and bolts of your presentation essentially is that financial, economic, and household stressors can lead to family stressors that impact early childhood experience, resilience, and ultimately ability to self-regulate, which impacts early childhood education. Is that Am I following?
Through the chair, yes. That's a great summary, and welcome to the group and to Juno. Yes, that plays a huge factor. And again, as mentioned, economics, we have one primary exchanging program, and that is cash. If you don't have that, it greatly reduces your ability to meet the needs of the family, which then plays into how you're able to meet the needs of your children. We have improved graduation rates. Heckman and them talked about that. They further argued that one of the most effective modes to increase graduation rates is to invest in at-risk children who are more likely to drop out of school. So this isn't always about doing something globally. Because as mentioned, our median income was $75,000, but when you took out white, that changed. So it is looking at the data in different ways and making sure you break it down and do some focus. You can have your greatest results. Their research strongly suggests that such investment is the most effective prior to kindergarten. Again, you saw that slide that Pat and I shared. Early childhood education programs have been shown to decrease teen birth rates. In turn, we know that teen childbearing lowers health care costs and other issues. Unplanned pregnancies have a strong link to FAS or child abuse and neglect and other issues. It's a very important aspect to reducing some of those traumas. I don't think we need to give much around increased employment. When people are employed, they're less dependent upon the social system and the safety net, and can be further economically contributing to the economy, which further helps it grow, and it has that positive cycle. Decreased welfare and those health care costs, early care and learning programs allow parents more opportunities to work or attend school, and therefore employment rates increase. This increase in labor force participation as a result of early childhood education can boost children's earnings later in life by 1 to 10%. Such opportunity reduces the dependency, again, on that safety net. Economic and earning outcomes, it reduces public education costs, less special needs. Also, you're having less of the issues that schools are dealing with. It has a huge cost savings, or more importantly, those costs can go more towards the full expected role of education, which is the educational component versus some of the behavioral aspects that they're dealing with. Pre-elementary school attendance has been shown to reduce future grade repeating. Children who attend a pre-elementary school program when they were 3 or 4 years of age were half as likely to be held back before second grade. It reduced grade being repeated, so again, you have those cost savings. And of course, it also increases the workforce. So I thank you for this opportunity. If you want to see the full report, many of you probably have received it, but you can also go to the Alaska Children's Trust website. It's easy to find. And the report is available through our Voices and Kids Count. So thank you for this opportunity. And throughout the next 3 days, you're seeing some of us who are members of the AECCC. I did not mention that that is a great honor that we have at the Children's Trust, but there's going to be many of us sitting there. And so as you have questions, some of them may be the perfect people to be able to answer this. There's a lot of experts at the table.
Thank you so much, Mr. Storrs. I really appreciate it. And based on the fact that many of you will be available over the next 3 days as we continue this in-depth look cross-department, let's reserve our questions for later on. It's going to take us – I know it's going to take me quite some time to absorb everything that I've heard today. And I'm sure that my co-chair agrees. And right now, we are going to do something lightning fast. We're going to take a brief at ease. So any members of the Health and Social Services Committee who are not also on the Education Committee can leave, after which it is my intention to move House Bill 339, Increase Base Student Allocation, from committee. Brief at ease. Members of House Education, if I could please have quiet in the room. We have before us House Bill 339. My staffer has handed out brand new copies of this bill. I have some very brief comments, but they're almost not necessary. After hearing what we just heard in the last couple of hours, I almost want to take this money and invest it in preschool and in pre-K. But that's not what this bill is about. We will get there. Since 2013, the Anchorage School District has cut nearly 400 full-time equivalent positions, a 9.3% reduction. 216 were teachers. Most of the remaining cuts were teacher assistants. Class sizes have increased around the district and will continue to do so. The Lake and Peninsula School District had no choice but to cut days off their school calendar due to lack of funding. We've been asking Alaska schools to do more with less and given them no more hours in the day or days in the year for decades. Check out the list from Peter Hefner of the Cordova School Board that I passed to the members of the committee late yesterday.
the ever-increasing burden on America's public schools. Alaska cannot attract business investment, retain families, or advance graduates to higher education without adequate support at the most basic level. Businesses of all kinds raise their prices as the cost of doing business increases. We are not covering the costs of the increased costs of doing business as schools, and hence this bill. Anchorage School District's chief financial officer said it best, streamline or reduction means impact on students. I've said for years that the third grader who must be reading competently by the year's end cannot wait until class size shrinks so he or she can get the attention they need to succeed. Teachers work very hard to help their students achieve. Let's keep as many teachers as we can and increase the base student allocation. Would anyone else like to comment on House Bill 339? Okay, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move version 30-LS0568/R of HB 339 from the Education Committee with attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, the bill is passing out of committee. Thank you. I'm going to take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. Will be Thursday, March 15th at 3 p.m., jointly with House Health and Social Services Committee, continuing our detailed look into early childhood development with the Alaska Early Childhood Coordinating Council. And with that, we are adjourned at 10:07 a.m.